I'm good, Dad. And when George and Pat both answered him, Beth began first to cry, then to breathe. Behind her, she could hear an enormous chorus of coughing and shuffling as assembled masses of Parkside and state officers who'd materialized from nowhere let go. It was she who leapt onto the steps then, she and Carrie and Beowulf, Beth inhaling his smell as eagerly as the dog did, engulfing the child, nearly knocking him down as he stiffened and finally backed away, reaching for George. "I know," the foster mother smiled, "but he's just stunned." Between supervised hour-long visits every other day, with the child they soon learned to call Sam. Pat and Beth consumed dozens of quarts of coffee and absorbed the information in reports Candy brought them, almost daily, of police interviews with Cecil at Silvercrest. The diagnosis, in lay terms, was catatonic depression. She was as still as a well, making no noise even when she yawned or scraped her leg on a piece of furniture. At Silvercrest, in Cecil's room, in the day room, in her supervising physician's office, Candy, and after her, Robert Bender and others, had spent hours with Cecil. They'd shown Cecil pictures, including a picture of Ben on Santa's lap, with his hair still dyed Vincent Brown, no more than 6 months after. How had she dared, Beth thought, and then thought, of course, what else would she have done? Was Cecil, after all, stupid, or just crazy? That picture, the one that attracted Beth most, had to have been taken the winter after the police interviewed Cecil, after she'd moved to Chicago from Minneapolis. Candy said Cecil's mother had confirmed the move, that Cecil had showed up with a grandson Mrs. Lockhart had never even met before. Beth pressed Candy. Why had Mrs. Lockhart believed Cecil? Didn't she connect the sudden grandson with Ben's much-publicized loss? All Candy could tell Beth was, it makes sense when she tells it. Cecil was so crazy. They had to do what she said, or she wouldn't talk to them for months at a time, and apparently either she was pregnant once or her mother thought she was. Her own time with Mrs. Lockhart was limited, Candy explained, exhausted by Beth's questions. They would hear more at Cecil's competency hearing later in the summer. The state of Illinois had charged Cecilia Lockhart Karras with aggravated kidnapping and stood prepared, depending on what was learned about the conditions under which Ben had lived for 9 years, to tack on everything except the abduction of Patty Hearst. But sending Cecil to prison would be redundant. No one had any lust for it, Beth, even Pat, least of all. None of the proceedings would, Beth thought, have any meaning for her at all. But she would attend in the secret hope that she could, just once, look into Cecil's face, to look into the face she'd been assured would relinquish nothing. But Beth had to know that, for herself. And until she could know, she would devote herself to the more constructive mission, the transformative task of bringing her son home. For a dime, Reese would have bagged the last couple of weeks of school, but he figured that all he needed to do was get his dad on edge, and his brand new driver's license would be folded five ways and stuck where the sun didn't shine in about 5 minutes flat. Dad was still Dad. In fact, he was extra jovial Dad, now that the sainted Sam was actually living under his roof, but he wasn't going to tolerate anything that would kick back on the family. Everywhere he went in school, some teacher had a copy of the People magazine, the one with Sam dribbling in the driveway on the cover, the one with the headline that said, "Back, but not Ben," and underneath, "The Incredible Odyssey of a Lost Boy." George Karras, the poor guy, had given them a whole bowlful of juicy quotes, but you could hardly blame George. Reese had told Tom Kilgore the long and short of it. George just wanted everybody to understand that it hadn't been him who kidnapped Ben, that he had no idea what his crazy wife was capable of doing. Because of that, George kept telling everybody who would listen that he'd raised Sam the best way he knew how, which Reese could testify to, because hadn't he seen Sam, or Ben, all those times without realizing it was Ben, and Sam had looked pretty ordinary in that driveway at the Red House. The last few days before school ended, Reese began taking a basketball into the deserted gym and trying some things in there. Half the time, Reese realized, he was hanging around after school trying to figure out what he was really feeling about Sam. The first time he saw Sam, in the counselor's office while Sam was still in foster care, Reese had almost started to cry. He was so glad. It was like Ben had this light all around him. And he couldn't believe that if he walked right up to the kid, Ben wouldn't just grab his arm and start talking about the time the squirrel got stuck in the car engine, or the time Ben fell off the end of the long pier at Lake Delavan, or about the treehouse in Madison. Even if Ben remembered the day in the lobby, fuck, Reese was just so glad Ben wasn't dead. But Ben, that is Sam, had looked Reese right in the face, and he couldn't have been faking it. He looked like he'd never seen Reese before in his life. Between concentrating on the shot and thinking about Sam, he didn't notice Teeter the day the coach came up behind him, reached over his head, and slapped the ball away. Reese's heart felt like he'd been filled with helium. What? He whirled around. Teeter was built like a mastodon.
If it ain't Capadora, the terror of the playground.
Teeter had that Weasley sort of southern voice Reese always associated with drill sergeants in movies.
I've been watching you in here, Vince. You thinking of coming out for the team next year?
I might try.
Reese looked at him evenly.
You think that the other guys be willing to put up with all your shit just because you got one shot?
Feeling the curling of his hands, the telltale signal Reese had come to fear, he answered,
I do okay.
You do okay, huh?
Teeter stuck his pork face right up next to Reese's.
You do okay, cause everybody feels sorry for you.
Teeter waved one broad finger under Reese's nose.
Come on, Capadora, you think you're such a big man. How about acting like it? Are you a big man or just a bully?
He scooped up the ball, Reese's own ball, balancing it in his big ham hands, and bounced it once off Reese's forehead. Then again. The bridge of Reese's nose stung like a son of a bitch. His eyes began to run, but he didn't put up his hands to block Teeter's attack. Teeter did it again, and again.
Big man, Reese, huh? Wanna go? What are you gonna do now? Can you take it, Capadora? Are you just a pussy deep down?
And he drew back to give the ball a little more punch, but then Reese's fist came up and he snatched the ball down, almost pulling Teeter off balance. The big man's face slackened, and he took a step back.
Look, Reese said then. Look, I just...
Forget it, Teeter said, whirling and slouching away. Your kind of attitude nobody needs, especially not me.
And Reese just stood there, both arms wrapped around his ball, holding it to his chest as tightly as he could, while Teeter flipped off the light switch to the overheads, leaving him in the dark. Sam fell asleep on a lawn chair, holding a rubber slice of pizza, about 8 o'clock on the first Saturday night, and at 9 the next morning was still heavily, soddenly asleep. Beth hated to haul him out, but Rosie and Angelo had arranged and paid for a special mass at Immaculata. Pat insisted all of them go, and go humbly, and was already arguing with Vincent about the condition of his chinos before Beth had had her first cup of coffee. Blocks from the church, Beth already noticed a kind of electricity in the streets. When they turned off Suffolk Avenue onto the boulevard, even Vincent gasped. The street in front of the church was blocked at both ends and clogged with satellite trucks and a welter of squads from a dozen villages and the city of Chicago, from the state, all with hood lights flashing, the concussion of rotating lights and floods creating a sort of artificial sunrise. On both sides of the plastic tape cordon, whole families stood craning over the heads of reporters, knocking over sawhorses. As it turned out, the Capadoras could park nowhere near the entrance, and they had to fight their way to the door of the church as the bells tolled for 11 o'clock mass.
None of the assembled masses seemed even to recognize them until they were on the threshold of the foyer door. What truly stunned Beth was the fact that the church somehow was filled not with leakage from the curious throngs outside, but with faces she recognized. Every face was lifted entire from her past and Pat's. As Beth and Pat walked up the aisle with the children to where Rosie, Angelo, and Bill stood, dressed in night-class finery, and holding open seats in the first pew, they passed dozens of outstretched hands and lifted tearful faces, classmates and neighbors, cops Beth had never seen out of uniform, even many who'd long since transferred to other departments, a whole contingent of Madison friends, Laurie, of course, her husband and children, but others too, the blind man on the corner who'd given Ben and Vincent lifesavers when Beth strolled them around the block with their big wheels a generation ago, and Linda, the waitress from Capadora's. The opening hymn was Amazing Grace, and Father Cleary, who'd known Beth and Pat all their lives, lost no time in forging the link. Today we celebrate, as we did in song, the mercy of God as symbolized by the homecoming of a child who was once lost but now is found. Beth didn't know what made her look over her shoulder. A rustle of sound at the back of the church, simple discomfort with the beginning of the liturgy, which she, lapsed and lacking, had struggled to follow. But she did. And just to the left of the aisle, small in his pinstriped blue suit, stood George Karras. From a distance of 30 yards, Beth could feel his agonized unease, the effort it took for him to stand still, without straining at his tie or shooting his cuffs. Had she stopped to think, she might have thought of a dozen things that would have stopped her from moving, the media possibilities, the possible wrath of various Capadoras, even the clutch of pity and dismay at her own stomach. She got up, eyes turning speculatively to follow her, and walked quietly to the back of the church and extended her hand, which George, gulping in humiliation and relief, took. She led him back toward the first pew, and it was only as she neared the family the last few feet that she dared look up, and it was Sam's face she saw, turned on her and George with a look she'd never seen on it before. It was, she later guessed, joy. Even after the nurse and the bailiff brought Cecilia in and settled her in the enclosure beside her attorneys, Beth forgot to sit down. She felt Pat pulling on her arm and sat down then with a thud. If she craned her neck slightly, though, she could still see the angelic, wide face of the nurse, and just beyond her, Cecil. Cecil wasn't only changed. She was buried. Crammed into pants and tunic, the willowy girl Beth remembered now was frankly fat, packed with rolls of flesh, odd protuberances where the skin was simply pushed beyond containing. Cecil's attorney, Michel Perrault, stood up now, small as a child, with feathers of short dark hair, dressed in jewel colors like a medieval troubadour. Your Honor, I've done this work for a very long time, relatively speaking, and I have spent many hours with my client, Mrs. Karras, over many days. I've been able to get nothing. Nothing out of her that gives me reason to believe that my client can understand the charges she faces. She shows no indication she knows there is someone talking to her at all. The judge was scribbling. Do we have other witnesses? Mrs. Karras's mother, Sarah Lockhart, is here today. With your permission, I'd like to ask her to describe her daughter's emotional state at the time of the kidnapping. The judge nodded to Perrault, who asked to call Sarah Lockhart. Beth still recognized Mrs. Lockhart. She hadn't seen her in 20 years. Perrault burrowed right in, asking Mrs. Lockhart how well she knew the little boy known as Sam Karras.
Very well indeed, Sarah Lockhart's eyes begged Bess. He was my grandson, but I never had any idea that he wasn't Cecilia's child, Cecilia's own child by birth.
But, Mrs. Lockhart, you weren't present for the birth of the child your daughter presented to you as your grandson.
No, she and I, Cecilia had a great deal of difficulty in her relationships with her father and me.
It was her third husband, Adam, who'd called one autumn night to tell them that Cecil was pregnant. Cecil had got on the line then, and they were all talking at once, so excited.
And you see, that's when it happened, Mrs. Lockhart looked at the lawyer. I told Adam her age.
You told Adam her age? Perot was confused.
I said something like, Cecilia, you need to be careful because you're nearly 30. That was all. Well, I later learned from Adam, I never knew him very well, and Cecilia absolutely forbid me to talk with him after she got really sick, that he thought Cecilia was 22 years old, and here I was, her own mother. She didn't speak to me again until the authorities contacted us. She was in Bellevue. Have you ever been there?
Mrs. Lockhart winced. It was long ago. Not long enough, thought Bess. Perot moved toward her.
But, Mrs. Lockhart, didn't you try to find out what had happened to the baby?
Of course I did, of course. But when Cecilia got better, she said she'd miscarried. We didn't bring it up again.
Perot frowned.
Then why, I'm sure it's crossed all our minds, given your daughter's problems, when Cecilia showed up with a child, why didn't you ever suspect that she'd abducted the Capodoro's boy and presented him to you as her own?
Sarah Lockhart sighed.
Cecilia said what really happened was that she'd had to give the baby to Adam because she was unable to care for him. She was ashamed of it, and so she just told me the baby was dead. That made sense, don't you see? Well, at least it made sense if you knew her. She was very strange, but also very compelling. She said she hadn't even seen her son from when he was a baby until he was 4. He was big. I believed he was 4, not 3.
She turned her gaze on Beth, and Beth felt her own eyes tug and itch in response.
Beth, she never spanked him. She never hurt his feelings. When Cecilia was well, she was gentle and tender to Sam. She always read to him. She taught him songs.
She shook her head.
I'm sorry, Beth.
To her shock, Beth said clearly, That's all right. She could hear the reporters exhale and then virtually read the headline, Ben's mother forgives kidnapper's mom. Beth had to resist turning every answer to Sam's questions into a 40-minute lecture. Had Beowulf liked him when he was a baby? Did he see Carrie right after she was born? Did Beth remember if he was allergic to chocolate? He was sure he was now, though George said that was just because he threw up after eating a whole pound bag of M&Ms. After weeks of the little questions, little answers, Beth had taken a plunge. She called Sam in one lazy Sunday afternoon and told him that she wanted to show him something. The apprehension in his eyes almost stopped her, but she pressed ahead, taking him upstairs to her and Pat's room, to where the large, hooped chest Rob Maltese had built for them as a wedding gift still sat, used mostly by Pat as a clothes rack for piles of shirts destined for the dry cleaner. She swept the shirts aside. Each of the children's christening gowns and coming-home outfits was sealed in a plastic envelope Beth bought from Sears, with photos and mementos of each of those momentous days, and placed reverently, impervious to time and shift, in the cedar chest. She lifted out first Vincent's package, letting Sam sift through its contents. He was curious, even avid. And then the one marked Benjamin Patrick Capodora. They're so little, Sam laughed. Was I ever really this small? They look like Carrie's doll clothes.
Ben lifted the lacy gown Rosie had so lovingly embroidered up to his nose, inhaling its sweet hamster cage scent.
What's that smell?
Cedar, Beth smiled. It's supposed to preserve clothes and keep moths away. Lots of closets are lined with it. Didn't you ever smell it before?
No, Sam frowned. It could be, maybe it was that my Yaya had a trunk like this. I think so. She brought it from Greece. Maybe I played with it when I was a kid.
But his face didn't register confidence.
At least I think so.
And then Beth noticed with growing excitement that tears were welling in his eyes. She'd never seen Sam cry, except for an instant at the intake center when he'd kissed George goodbye. Now he was scrubbing at his eyes with 12-year-old modesty, shaking his head.
What? Sam?
Beth dared to think, this is it. Something, some gear has engaged. He remembers. And then Sam had reached out and patted Beth on the shoulder.
I'm just so sorry, Beth.
For what, honey?
I'm sorry that because this happened to you. I know you loved this. Loved me so much when you did this. I'm so sorry.
Sam, you don't have to feel that way.
He shook his head, more fiercely this time.
But I also think you believe that my mom and dad are bad people, and they're really not,
he went on, Beth barely hearing him, her stomach gone icy.
Just because I'm really sorry that this happened doesn't mean I don't love my dad, and I love my mom too, Beth. She doesn't mean to be sick.
Numbly, Beth nodded, mechanically reaching for the christening gown, folding it against the creases so it wouldn't molder. Sam was crying hard now, hiccuping. She wanted to hold him against her, stroke his broad back with its immature and jutting bones.
Beth, can I see my dad today?
When he'd gotten back, later, from George's house, Sam was lighter, less antsy. He'd played a game of sorry with Carrie. He'd come right out and asked Vincent to shoot some hoops. But Beth had never forgotten the supplication in his face as he knelt by the chest, the confusion in his voice about the right way to talk to kindly strangers, to convince them to help you find your way home. She tried to tell Pat about the cedar chest. He'd brushed it away. "Bethy, do you remember being 6 weeks old?" He'd laughed then. "Don't stew over it. He'll come around." Pat would listen now. He'd have no choice. Beth lay on her bed with her eyes open, remembering a feeling from girlhood, from days that she'd come out of a movie theater, blinking into the ebbing light of a Saturday afternoon, disoriented in time, sick with the sense that something had been wasted. She pulled a pillow over her face, willing the slams and muffled calls, the activity of the house, to recede. The next sound she heard was Pat's voice, from far off, shouting to her that Sam was gone.
"He's outside, Pat."
Beth, still fuddled with sleep, stumbled down the stairs.
"What time is it? Is it morning? He went down to the school to shoot baskets."
She glanced around the empty kitchen. Pat shook his head. "It's 5 o'clock in the morning, Beth. He wouldn't go out to shoot baskets at 5 in the morning. Anyhow, I looked everywhere. Jesus Christ, Beth. Jesus Christ, where is he?" The doorbell rang. Beth watched as Pat's face literally leaked color, like an ink wash in a bath, down across his cheekbones, his neck. "Oh, Bethy. Oh, God, no." It was Beth who crossed to open the door, her own heart now jerking like a cat in a sack. On the porch in the first morning sunlight stood Sam and George, George's arm gently propelling Sam forward. Sam's face was creased with tears and sleep. Beth could smell the milk on his breath. He half turned back toward George, who nodded, urging him, and followed Sam inside.
I'm sorry, Beth and Pat. I'm real sorry he did it again.
Pat was clawing at his hair. Did what? Did what again, George? George looked confused from Beth to Pat, then back over his shoulder where the newly risen sun's glare above the rock garden was brightest. Someone was standing just at the turn of the drive. Someone. Beth shaded her eyes. It was Vincent.
The first time Sam climbed out of his room in the middle of the night, climbed up the rose trellis outside his old room, knocked out the screen and got into his bed, George explained, had been another of those nights when Beth had gone to bed early and Pat had been at the restaurant. And, of course, he, George, was ready to bring Sam right back.
I mean, I love my son. I'm sorry, Beth. I love Sam, is what I mean. But I knew you'd be out of your mind with worry, and you'd think that I, like, let him do this.
But as soon as he'd given Sam some toast and a hug, and taken him outside to the front porch, well, there was Reese, hunched in his jacket, astride his bike. Reese, who gave George a worldly shrug and assured him that he'd see the wanderer home and explain everything to the folks. That same thing had happened the second time, and the third time, and this time too. Beth looked at Sam.
Vincent never told us.
Sam looked away.
I know. We agreed to not tell you.
Go up to your room, Sam. Pat was so stern, everyone, including Sam, was visibly surprised.
What did I do?
Sam glared at Pat.
You ran away. You scared the hell out of your mother and me. That's what you did, and you've done it before. You could have broken your neck or gotten hit by a car or worse.
Pat pushed his face close to Sam's. Hasn't enough happened to this family? Hasn't there been enough hurt to go around for everyone?
Yeah.
Sam gathered himself, thrust forth his chest. He was nearly as tall as Pat, and broader. Oh, she thought, he's not going to back off now. He has a Cappadocia's temper. He has a Carrie's stubbornness. He's going to say it. And then, ashamed of her glancing jolt of relief, she thought, then, at least I won't have to.
Yeah, there's been enough. I mean, I'm sick of this whole thing.
What whole thing? Pat cocked his head.
This whole thing. Tears gathered in the corners of Sam's eyes and slowly, beautifully, spilled from the fan-shaped ends of his long lashes. I'm sick of this. I want to go home. I want my dad. I can go to court and get you to give me to my dad. I read it at school.
Go upstairs now, Sam. George looked steadily at Sam.
Lie down for a while. I'll come and see you before I go, okay?
And ball tomorrow night, huh? Okay? Sam lurched from the table, nearly shoving George off balance.
I hate you. I hate you, and I hate your dumb, ugly house and your dumb freako son with a peanut butter name. I'm never coming back.
Knocking over a chair, Sam ran for the stairs and up, two at a time. Beth could hear him strike the wall three times in the upper hall, and then the echo of his slamming door.
I'm so sorry, George whispered. The poor little sucker.
George, nobody blames you. Beth rushed to make coffee, bringing napkins, bringing cream in a pitcher, bringing matching spoons, all things she never did.
I wanted to write by him.
George slammed his palm down on the table.
I want him to be happy. And if you guys are the guys that can give him the family he deserves, God damn it, then you give him that. But I gotta tell you, Beth, Pat, this kid is the saddest kid in the world right now. I've never seen this kid sad for more than 12 hours in his life. It's not in Sam.
Then George stood up hurriedly, knocking the chair over, catching it before it hit the floor.
I'm going, you guys. I'm sorry again.
They both made as if to rise, but George waved them down with a weary motion of his hand. Beth and Pat sat at the table, the brand new coffee in three mugs cooling between them. I'll make breakfast, Beth thought. I'll get up and do that. In silence, one by one, they came to the table and ate. Sam collected the dishes to stack in the dishwasher.
Now I'll sit on the porch, Beth thought. When she went outside, she found Pat watering the roses.
Patty, I guess we better talk.
If you want, Beth.
He's not happy. What happened last night? That's just the tip of it.
Pat turned his back on her and began scraping at the leaves with a hoe he found against the side of the house. What are you getting at?
Beth sat down on the grass. Patty, George is his father.
For an instant, Beth thought Pat would strike her. What he did instead was grab the hose and throw it, hard, against the trunk of a tree, so that it undulated in the air like a cobra, spraying droplets over both of them. Beth, what are you suggesting exactly, that we give Sam back to the people who stole him when he was a baby? Are you nuts, Beth? Pat was yelling now. If you think I'm crazy enough to go along with anything that would take my son away from me again, after all that hell. I don't want anything to do with it, Beth, or anything to do with you. I mean it. Beth glanced around the yard and stood up. Tell him now, she thought. It's too late in the day for a coward's politeness. Tell him so he can't pretend he doesn't already know. Lay out the evidence, brick on brick, so that he can't say later he never really understood, never really knew that their baby, their Ben, had been right. There was a deep end of the ocean. Ben had gone there, and he hadn't come back. They could never go there with him, or know what he'd experienced, or truly understand what had made him. They could only see the result. Ben had walked out of the waves like a sturdier Venus, springing from the foam, fully grown, transformed. He'd walked out, Sam Karras, a fine boy any parent would be proud to have raised. But Beth and Pat hadn't. Pat's face was shut, truculent. Would it be a waste of breath? Tell him, Beth thought.
Pat, I think there are a lot of things going on you just don't want to see, and one of them is that I'm not the enemy here. Don't you think I want the same thing you want? If I could take a pill, or Sam could, and we'd all forget this ever happened, don't you think I would?
Pat paused before he answered. I don't know whether you would, Beth. Losing just one kid one time wasn't enough. He stopped.
Beth knuckled her forehead. If you want to, you can say that after Ben was lost, it was my fault that Vincent got lost too. You can say that because it makes it easier for you. But I was as good as I could be then too, and the reason that my best wasn't very good wasn't just the grief. It was probably because I believed, just like you did, that it was my doing. I felt that I could easily let Vincent down, simply by being his mom.
Pat was crying now, but Beth knew she couldn't afford to give in to either rage or pity. She couldn't, wouldn't stop. She'd talk until the window slammed shut.
And you know what the only thing we still have is? Awareness. We can be aware that we have two sons, and they're both strangers in our house. And if we don't pretend this isn't true, maybe we can save something out of it. You've pretended long enough. You could say I have too. How we got here doesn't matter.
Pat looked at her then. What does then? What do you want from me? And if Beth had ever doubted it, she was sure at that instant that there was to be no shared responsibility for the consequences of whatever happened with Sam. Even if Pat didn't hate her, and she could see from the shame in his eyes that he didn't any longer dare hate her, he'd still be unable to say to his family, "We talked it over, we decided that Sam is too unhappy this way. We decided what was best for us to do." There would be no "we" about it. Pat wouldn't be disloyal to her, but it would be salt plain that he was living with a choice that Beth had made. And now, she would have to make it. The guard pulled the metal-armed chair out for Reese and motioned for him to sit down. And then he left, silently, as if vaporized.
If anybody asked him, Rhys couldn't have sworn whether 4 hours had passed or 40. But it had to be Saturday, just later Saturday. When he saw his mom outside the door, he suddenly had a memory flash from the hospital emergency room. Red jeans. She still had on the same red jeans. The no-contact visiting room was supposed to be soundproof. There was a vanilla-colored telephone on his side that he could use to speak to his visitors when they came in. But he could watch his mom already, through the long rectangle of the window of the door opposite, standing in profile, as if the window were a picture frame, her head hanging down, her fuzzy dark hair shadowing her face. She was talking to someone, and when she shifted back to pick up her shoulder bag, that someone reached for her. Candy. The swan arms and frosted fingertips, unmistakable, even in a blue blazer-type thing, the kind of thing he hardly ever saw Candy wear. Candy put her arms around Rhys's mom and stroked Beth's hair. Rhys would have given anything at that moment to hear. He laid his head down on the formica laminate of the counter, forcing himself not to cringe at the contact. Soundproof. Ah, yes. Another triumph of technology. Not. He heard his mom say something about him being better off at home. Rhys heard another voice, muffled. Dad. Oh, good Christ. But Candy's voice was louder. Well, yeah, Pat, you know all this shit. What kids do if they're hurting kids like Rhys? He's not going to come up to you and say, Well, Dad, I didn't really mean for Sam to leave, though I'm not entirely sorry he did. This is bothering me. They can't do that. Rhys especially. So he has to do something crazy. Something so big it draws all the attention off how he feels about this. Rhys heard his mother's soft voice again. Oh, Beth, said Candy, her voice tangy with irritation. You know he thinks everything is his fault. And you know, Beth, I don't want to scare you. You've been scared enough for 10 people in one life. But you know how many car accidents are suicide attempts for kids? You know that? I'm not trying to lay blame on top of this, but let's think about what he's going through. Whose fault? Not yours, Mom. No way. Rhys rubbed his neck. His skin felt coated with syrup. He was accreting every piece of grit in this place. Rhys didn't even notice the kid, but Sam was already holding his telephone. Rhys picked it up. How long you been there, Sam?
A minute.
The kid looked scared to death, and he looked little, shrunken. He had on a Cubs shirt.
Are you okay, Rhys?
Rhys automatically reached up to touch the bandage on the back of his head, where they'd stitched. It stung. He still couldn't figure out how the hell he'd banged the back of his head running into a light pole with the front of Teeter's car.
I'm okay. It doesn't hurt.
What did you do?
I took Teeter's car. I wasn't going to keep it. I was just going to ride around.
Teeter the coach?
Yeah, that asshole.
And so why didn't you just bring it back?
I was going to, but this goon I know, Schaffer and I, we were goofing around, and when I saw the cops, I just went faster.
Were you drunk? That's what Beth said.
I was overserved, yes, Sam. I was drunk, but I never did anything this bad before.
How fast were you going?
I don't know, like 90?
Sam's eyes blinked and fastened on Rhys. He grinned.
90?
And it occurred to Rhys that maybe he should go easier here. That Sam was probably not just ordinarily fucked up, but a little more than ordinarily, just barely back with George and all. A couple of weeks at his own house after the foray into Cappadora land, and now this shit. He was such a kid. Oh, Ben.
Look, Sam, I don't know if you know.
Rhys looked over at his parents and Candy. Soundproof, my ass.
I don't know if you know how incredibly stupid what I did was.
Well, Rhys, yeah, I do.
I mean, really, monumentally stupid, Sam.
Yeah?
like I'm a jerk, Sam.
No, Sam shook his head.
I'm a fuck-up, and it's not funny. It's not cool.
Reese was almost whispering now, leaning toward the partition.
Reese, I just thought...
What did you think, Sam?
Reese, I gotta tell you something. I remembered something.
Yes, Sam, what?
When I was at your house, Beth showed me this trunk, the trunk at the foot of her bed. She took out all these baby clothes she said were mine, and she showed me some blankets and stuff. Some pictures.
Reese made a weary circular motion with one hand.
And I didn't remember any of them, Reese.
Oh. Reese's weariness was deafening. So long as the kid didn't remember the lobby, what the fuck did he care? How much, Reese thought, how much more? Isn't this enough, Mom? Sam leaned toward the partition.
But I remember the smell.
Reese sighed. The smell. Sam nodded.
I remembered the smell of the cedar chest from being inside it.
Reese let the phone drop, almost. It was as if Mom, gesturing, shrugging her shoulders outside the window, asking if Sam wanted to come out, was on film instead of real. He could feel his short self running up those stairs in Madison, into the little room half made over for baby Carrie, where they dumped everything, pulling over the boxes of diapers and clothes and whispering, "Ben, Ben, where are you, Ben?" Running back down, thinking of the dryer, thinking, "Mommy will kill me if he's in the dryer and turning blue." He wasn't in the dryer. A pulse thudding in his neck. He couldn't let his mother hear. She'd screech. She'd grab his hair.
Reese looked at Sam, who was still talking. "We were playing hide-and-seek?"
"I know, Sam." Reese adjusted the telephone, which had gone slimy in his wet hand. Sam looked quizzically at Reese.
"Did that really happen?"
"It really happened. You let the lid shut, and it caught."
"I knew it! I knew it!" The kid smiled. "I can really remember lying there in the dark. There were these cracks of light, so it wasn't totally dark. I was lying there on some clothes or something, and the top was so high I couldn't even touch it unless I sat up. And at first I tapped on the top, but nobody came, and I thought I couldn't breathe, but I could. So I just stayed there, and finally you came and opened the top of the chest."
Reese nodded. "And you were there. You were just there. Not scared or anything. Just got up and got out."
"See, that's the thing, Reese. That's what I remember."
"What?"
"That I wasn't scared. I wasn't scared because I knew..."
Sam paused. "Yes, Sam?"
"I knew you'd come and find me."
Beth sat down one day and tried to think of a couple she knew well who'd been through a divorce. But unless she counted Candy, and she didn't really count Candy, that wasn't a real divorce, she didn't know anyone to compare things with. Candy's tender parting from Chris had been more like a return to the organic nature of their friendship after an experimental grafting that had failed to take. It had been decided and was over within a matter of a couple of weeks, decided and acted upon as suddenly, and to Beth as surprisingly, as the marriage. Chris and Candy had dinner together after court. Surely that wasn't what most divorces were like. Beth had never seen a couple sunder from the inside. 2 days after Sam returned home, and that was how Beth forced them all to put it, Pat had taken to sleeping downstairs. Returning Sam had been a decorous procedure. Only George had wept. They'd met with a social worker, and then had a brief hearing in chambers with a family court judge. The judge had asked each of them, including Sam, who sat rigid in his chair, whether this was a decision made out of free will. Beth spoke first.
"With a great deal of sadness, but yes, freely."
"And Mr. Capodora?" There was a long interval of murderous silence, and then, "Yes." Pat didn't look at Bess. But she'd reached out and put her hand on his arm, under the starched cotton of his long-sleeved shirt. The arm was still as marble. Not even a nerve answered her touch. Asked about his willingness, George, suffused with emotion, could only nod mutely. The judge then asked to speak to Samuel Karras Capadora alone, and emerged 15 minutes later, slightly red about the eyes, his palms turned up. There would be, he explained, no formal custody decree granted at this time. Sam would be permitted weekly visits, unsupervised, with his natural parents, the duration of those visits to be determined by George in concordance with the Capadoras. "I hope that he'll have some interaction with his birth siblings," the judge leaned forward, "for their emotional well-being as well as his own." But no one except Beth really understood what had happened. But really, how could anyone grasp it? They hadn't seen Sam's face at the cedar chest. They hadn't seen his eyes. It was that image, the image of the quiet Sunday that Beth kept in her mind throughout the formalities of the return. It sustained her. She couldn't describe it to anyone. It was like trying to describe yellow to a child sightless from birth. The feel of the sun, the velvet of a daffodil. Beth could only cling to the certainty that she'd known when Sam looked up at her after inspection of his baby clothes, that she and Pat had guardianship only over Sam's physical body. In spite of all the gestures and resemblances, the eyes and chin and freckles that wrung her heart, whatever had once constituted their connection had evaporated. Pat drove his son to every counseling appointment with Tom, waiting for him outside. He visited the youth officer with Vincent. He closed Vincent's door behind them at night when he went in to say goodnight. Even when Beth offered to spell him, to take Vincent to see Tom on nights when she knew the session would make Pat late for opening at wedding, Pat had refused. "I owe him, Beth. I owe him. And even if I didn't owe him, he's the only son I have." The day he said that, Beth had sent for the catalogs, applications, for the master's program in fine arts at the University of Wisconsin. She'd filled them out, sending her application fee, not entirely certain what she was trying to accomplish. Did this mean she actually meant to leave Pat? Move away? She'd left some papers lying on a coffee table several days after they came, and caught Pat's glance at them. She stopped him in one of his headlong dashes in the door from some Vincent thing to grab his jacket for work. "Pat, I thought I might consider taking some time, maybe a semester, so we can think things over. I thought I could maybe rent a little place. Carrie and Vincent could go to school at Edgewood, maybe, if we can afford it." He'd come full stop then, his look as if he were taking her by both shoulders, squaring her to face him. "Carrie might be okay, and it's something we can talk about after you make up your mind. But Vincent isn't going to leave this house with you. Not ever. He isn't going to leave this house until he goes to college, if, I pray to God, I can figure out how to get him out of high school in one piece and get him to believe he can do anything except screw up his life." Beth loved him then, loved him desperately, his deep, utter Pat Capadora goodness. It was, after all, a kindness, in a sense, that she might leave. If she'd ever been worthy of him, she wasn't now. Pat drove his son to every counseling appointment with Tom, waiting for him outside. He visited the youth officer with Vincent. He closed Vincent's door behind them at night when he went in to say goodnight. Even when Beth offered to spell him, to take Vincent to see Tom on nights when she knew the session would make Pat late for opening at wedding, Pat had refused. "I owe him, Beth. I owe him. And even if I didn't owe him, he's the only son I have." The day he said that, Beth had sent for the catalogs, applications, for the master's program in fine arts at the University of Wisconsin. She'd filled them out, sending her application fee, not entirely certain what she was trying to accomplish. Did this mean she actually meant to leave Pat? Move away? She'd left some papers lying on a coffee table several days after they came and caught Pat's glance at them. She stopped him in one of his headlong dashes in the door from some Vincent thing to grab his jacket for work.
"Pat, I thought I might consider taking some time, maybe a semester, so we can think things over. I thought I could maybe rent a little place. Carrie and Vincent could go to school at Edgewood, maybe, if we can afford it."
He'd come full stop then, his look as if he were taking her by both shoulders, squaring her to face him. "Carrie might be okay, and it's something we can talk about after you make up your mind. But Vincent isn't going to leave this house with you. Not ever. He isn't going to leave this house until he goes to college, if, I pray to God, I can figure out how to get him out of high school in one piece and get him to believe he can do anything except screw up his life." Beth loved him then, loved him desperately, his deep, utter Pat Cappadora goodness. It was, after all, a kindness, in a sense, that she might leave, if she'd ever been worthy of him. She wasn't now. Two nights after Beth sent her application to Madison, Candy dropped by. Her self-conscious new Chiefs bearing all dropped, girlish in jeans and a paint-splattered shirt. She kissed Pat in passing as he left for work and plopped down on the porch. "Give me a vodka, Beth. I've spent all day painting my disgusting single-girl flat in preparation for my disgusting single girl's life, and I feel old as dirt." They sat on the porch, and Beth wondered if she only imagined Candy shooting glances down toward the corner around which Sam lived. Both of them tipped their feet on the railing and listened to the crickets. Beth turned to Candy.
"You know what? I think Pat and I are separating."
Candy tossed the remains of her drink out into the bushes and slammed down the glass.
"Good Christ, Beth, why? Isn't enough enough?"
Beth shrugged.
"Candy, he wants it too."
Candy got up and sat on the railing.
"That's just pride. He's just played out. You don't make these decisions after a summer like this. And what about Reese and Carrie?"
"He's going to fight to keep them here. He doesn't want me to take them back to Madison."
"To Madison?"
"Well, Candy, what's left for me here? Annual follow-ups of the many permutations and combinations of the Cappadora saga in the Tribune magazine? No, shit, I'm not doing it."
Beth got up and sat down on the cement stoop.
"Candy, I don't know how to even think of leaving Reese or Carrie. And I know that if I move, I'll lose all my contact with Sam."
"But you're played out, too, aren't you, girlfriend?"
Candy kneeled next to Beth.
"Oh, Bessie, Bessie."
Candy rocked her, and Beth felt her tears come like the letdown of milk when she'd nursed the babies. Unstoppable. Purging. Candy sighed.
"When are you leaving?"
"I don't know," Beth sat up, rubbing her face on her T-shirt tail. "Maybe soon."
"Oh, my God, my God." Candy shook her head. "Pat's gonna miss you like he's lost an arm."
She stood up and gathered up her mammoth bag.
"And Bethy, he's not the only one. I will, too."
"You sure you don't want another drink?"
Beth was suddenly loath for Candy to leave.
"No, I don't want to have to give myself a field sobriety test, even though I'm now out of the fertility sweepstakes for good. Maybe now that I don't have to live on slave wages, I think sometimes there's this little girl living on a mountain in Chile somewhere who wants a crazy mama who carries a gun. So maybe,"
Beth grinned.
"I think that would be wonderful. You'd be a wonderful mother."
"So would you, Beth."
Candy walked down the steps. It was after 11 when Reese thought he heard the clang of a basketball on the driveway. The night was moonless, murky, the only light from the street lamp a block away. The ball hit again, twice, sharply. Reese had to flip the bedside lamp off to be able to tell who it was. It was Sam. Reese thought of putting on a shirt, but it was so damn hot anyway. He just jumped down the stairs by threes. What the hell was the kid doing hanging around the driveway at midnight? He ran out the door, and Sam was standing there, sunburned, in cutoffs and Reese's White Sox jersey.
"That's my shirt," Reese pointed at it automatically.
"I took it when I left. I'm sorry, Reese. You can have it."
"Have it, Sam, or have it if you beat me. So, that is, you might as well give it up now, unless it smells."
Reese couldn't take his eyes off the kid. It had been like weeks since he'd seen him at the jail. His dad and mom had taken Sam out twice, but Reese had been busy both times.
"Are you sure your dad knows where you are?"
Reese was checking the ball. Sam smiled.
"You keep putting off the game. I think you're scared."
Reese bounced the ball once.
"Make it, take it, to 11.
By the time the score stood 7-5, Reese ahead. Both of them were gasping in the humid darkness. They could feel their lungs flap like wet gloves.
"Hey, Reese, you got air inside?"
Sam was panting.
"Full blast.
Let's call it a night, Sam. Come back tomorrow for a rematch."
That was when Sam put his hands up and pushed the wet hair up over his forehead so it stuck straight up like mowed grass. He didn't move. Reese stopped, heaving and sweating, flat-footed in the driveway. Sam took a deep breath.
The thing is, I'm not going back.
What do you mean, Sam?
Sam jerked his head over his right shoulder, and there, at the end of the driveway in the dark, where Reese hadn't even noticed it, was a huge, battered suitcase.
Sam, man, what are you doing?
My dad knows. I mean, we talked about it a lot last week for a long time, and he said I have to do what I have to do, and he even knows why I came over so late at night.
Reese cocked his head.
Which was why?
Sam looked up at the darkened bedroom windows.
I didn't want to have this whole big number, you know, with Beth and Pat.
Okay.
Reese almost swallowed his tongue over the words.
But is this, like, permanent?
Sam looked down at his feet, his mouth clamped shut.
I don't know.
He looked up at Reese.
I don't know. Maybe. If I can, I hope.
Reese made a motion, stopping him. And Sam stopped, turned, and went down to the end of the driveway to get his suitcase. After a beat, Reese followed. You felt like you were diving in a quarry, it was so dark. Reese had to strain to see Sam's expression in the faint cast from that corner light. The corner around which you would walk, cross one side street, and then spot the red door. The only door on that block that wasn't blue or gray or brown. Reese could picture it now, clearer than he could the sweat-shaped brim of his rocket's hat. The red door meant Sam's house. Now not Sam's. Maybe. He could ask again, but the answer wouldn't make any difference. It was like everything. You just had to wait until morning and then count and see who was left. You had to keep walking until you figured out what was the right place. Keep on searching until somebody found you. Reese looked up at the light, then back at the patch of darker dark that contained his brother.
We should just go in, is all.
But fuck, thought Reese. I have to. I have to, sometime. I have to now.
I was the one, Sam. I was the one who let go of your hand.
Sam shifted his feet and sighed.
Well,
they picked up the suitcase, even weight, like it was a mattress, and carried it between them to the porch. They struggled into the hall, and Sam noticed the stack of Beth's bags, her suitcase and equipment.
Who's going on a trip?
My mom is maybe going to Wisconsin for a job.
Maybe. Now maybe not. Suitcases could be packed. Suitcases could be unpacked. You just had to wait. Reese turned to Sam.
Just sleep in my room, just for tonight, so we don't have to get out all sheets and stuff. The whole house will be up.
Where will you sleep, Reese?
I don't know. Down here on the couch, with Beowulf. And I'm not even tired.
Sam shook his head. It seems kind of crummy to come along and kick you out of your bed.
No, really, Sam. I'll take first watch, okay?
Sam smiled. Okay.
I'll walk the perimeter, Reese said.
Sam rummaged in his suitcase and extracted his toothbrush. Always the good kid.
Look for suspicious activity. Righto, sir, and have a good sleep.
Reese moved toward the couch.
I won't rest until the encampment is secured.
Ben headed up the stairs.
Well done.
Reese could just flop on the couch. It was unoccupied for once. Not like the last few weeks. Dad was sleeping upstairs in their bed. Reese had no idea whether that meant he was trying to get her to stay or saying goodbye. But anyway, it meant that there was vacant real estate on the first floor, and Reese would wake up if anybody moved. He always did. He'd given his word, though, and it was only a few more hours, the tail end of one night. Night could only last so long.
Until the encampment is secured, Reese thought. Or until morning, whichever comes first.
The Deep End of the Ocean was written by Jacqueline Michard and read by Dana Ivey. The producer was Jan Werner. This has been a presentation of Penguin Audiobooks.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.